Blog Talk Radio.
Baby, go and fetch it for me. Bring me a sandwich and a old Milwaukee. And don't be talking whilst I'm watching TV. Go and fetch it for me. It is your privilege to serve and obey my every command. You will be seen and not heard, and you'll try to look good for your man. But if you disappoint me and you fall short of my expectations, I'll throw you away. I'm a man, and that's what mans do. Baby, go and fetch it for me. The wrestling match is coming on Channel 3. If there's anything else I need, you can fetch it for me. I could use another old Milwaukee. Go and fetch it for me. Good girl.
How? Hey, everybody. James Bosick here, Conservative's Perspective on the Patriot Nation Radio Network here at Blog Talk Radio, blogtalkradio.com. You can swing over here and then you can type in Patriot Nation Radio. Or you can check out any of the links that are liberally besprinkled about the World Wide Web of Intrigue and Danger. Man, you know, I've told you guys this before. I've been doing this for about 5 or 6 years now, but I've been a news geek for many, many years before that. And it's just like I wrote today. I try to come up, and I'm not always successful, I know that, but I try to come up with some kind of snappy, catchy little turn of phrase for each one of these shows when I post them on social media. And I've gone back to it time and time again. Fundamentally, it's just this program is just an ongoing episode or expose of why people on the left are crazy. I mean, they make it easy, don't get me wrong, but that's it. This is just another episode in a continuing series, perhaps a never-ending or seemingly never-ending series of exposés as to why these guys are moon bats. Excuse me. We also have a recorded version of the program that goes out on Mojo 50 Radio, mojo50.com. They're listed on all kinds of apps, iHeartRadio, Pandora, Spotify, iTunes, I'm sure, just, you know, all over the place. And you can also go to YouTube because some of these cats have a video presence as well, and you might want to check that out. Or you can just go to mojo50.com. They have a show tab there, and you can find out when your scheduled show is going to be playing, or if you want to go into the archive and catch up on an episode you missed, you can do that. And you can listen right there at mojo50.com. Your one-stop shop for the very best in libertarian and conservative talk radio out there. Okay, now. Holy cats, by God, I really just don't know where to begin. John Bolton is out as National Security Advisor. The president has expressed on more than one occasion that he and Bolton didn't necessarily see eye to eye on a number of issues, foreign policy wise. So he's fired. And it's gonna, and you know, there's always the backstory, isn't there? There's always some kind of theater associated with Donald Trump and all the things that go on around him. And Donald Trump says he fired the guy. John Bolton said he resigned. It's been in the works for a while. Okay, this has been coming for some time. And the media, now those people in the know obviously knew, which, you know, discounts and excludes everybody in the establishment media. But there have been a number of points where the president and Secretary Bolton disagreed. Some of the stuff, you know, okay. Well, the foreign policy hawks see Bolton's exit as a sign of weakening on Iran, and apparently the pro-Iran people look at it the same way, because they celebrated this firing resignation. But neither of these guys in either of these camps are you know, justified in doing what they're doing. It's unlikely that the president is going to shift his policy of maximum pressure on Iran, because it is something that he believes in, number one. And number two, more importantly, I think, it's working. So we're not going to see a whole lot of change in terms with what's going on with Iran. After Bolton was appointed in March of 2018, they hadn't been there that long, the U.S. withdrew from the failing Iran nuclear deal and started to reimpose sanctions on the Iranian regime, on the mullahs. And the administration also carried out some pretty crucial pro-Israel policies, like pulling out of the United Nations Human Rights Council and recognizing Israeli sovereignty as it was concerned with the Golan Heights. Trump believes in what he's doing with Iran, and he's also made a strong personal commitment to Israel, and he mentions it at every opportunity, and that's not going to change either with Bolton. Now, and as far as China goes, where this administration, by the way, is winning, they're crushing in the trade war, and where support is coming in from all across the political spectrum, and basically across the globe as well. I mean, if George Soros is behind you on this, then I don't know if you're doing something right, because Soros is fundamentally James Bond villain type evil. But all these people seem to agree that what's happening with China in terms of the trade war is working, and it's working to America's benefit. And that's all that we're going to look at. Where change is going to happen, though, we haven't talked a lot about China or Hong Kong, and we are going to get into those things one of these days. Where the change is going to happen is going to be in places where the president feels that maybe showing a softer face might help. Foremost among these is North Korea. Bolton's tough stance was a challenge from the beginning. Though Trump and Bolton played, you know, good cop, bad cop with a certain level of success, it became clear that North Korea wanted to see more compromise from the United States before making any additional concessions. So the chances for a deal, good or bad, and right now it's leaning towards good, are vastly improved. In Afghanistan, President Trump roughly favors a similar approach to Barack Obama and wants to reach an agreement to allow an orderly U.S. withdrawal. Unlike Obama, he's not willing to negotiate under fire, but he's looking for an exit, and I think justifiably so. 18 years is a long time. Finally, the president probably wants a rapprochement with Russia, which Bolton likely did not. Now, he will confront Russia if necessary. We've seen that. Trump also believes, though, that Russia is the key to other deals. So we've got to have them as a player. Not necessarily staking them, but just making sure they get a seat at the game. The president has this pattern. Donald Trump has this pattern of keeping people around for the specific or unique tasks that only they can accomplish. And then when they're done, he swaps them out for new people. Now, there's no question that we would not have had a strong policy on Iran without John Bolton. It's probably true that he went a long way towards reshaping U.S. policy towards the United Nations, China, Venezuela, and the Palestinians in ways that were way overdue. And he was able to do it without launching any wars, as the critics said he would. But now that Trump wants to advance on peace talks in North Korea and Afghanistan, he needs a different set of skills. He thinks, the president that is, thinks like a businessman and not a politician. The questions he asks are, you know, what does any employee contribute to the organization now, right here and now, not whether he should reward their past performance. So in the long run, in terms of foreign policy, you're going to be able to look for consistency and very little change on Iran, Venezuela, and China, but on North Korea, in Afghanistan, and with Russia, Trump wants more progress, and that will be the job of the next national security advisor, whoever that may be. Got to hit the mute button. Hold on. I am so terribly sorry. Now, a lot of people, if you've noticed, have looked at the turnover in the last couple of years throughout the president's cabinet and on his staff. And they find it fundamentally alarming that there's such high turnover. They say that this indicates instability, uncertainty, inconsistency, not necessarily. Just like John Nolte said, there were specific problems that have confronted the administration as it's progressed. And in confronting those situations, the president reaches into his toolbox. You don't use a screwdriver to hammer in a nail. Consequently, you don't use a hammer to tighten up a bolt. So he looks at the problem. He looks at the job to be done, the goal, the task, the objective to be achieved, and he decides what is the best way to go about doing that. And where John Bolton worked like a charm concerning getting things set up and the stability we have in our foreign policy vis-a-vis China, Venezuela, and Iran, we're now looking to move somewhere else. And now we're going to be moving beyond, I don't want to say a blunt instrument, because Bolton's a finesse player. He's a diplomat, first and foremost, and he handled the job that he was assigned, again, without, you know, any military conflict opening up and all that's concomitant with that. Not exactly sure who it's going to be in the making, but I imagine whoever it is that the president picks, it'll be the person he thinks best suited to achieve the new set of goals. And after that guy does what he does, who knows? Don't be surprised if he gets, you know, tossed. It happens. Oh, by the way, I forgot to ask you guys, how's everything going this evening? Pretty good. We're in the middle of a heat wave here in the Mountain State. It got in excess of 90 degrees here today, September 10th. That's okay. It's cool. Don't worry about it. Well, it's not cool. It's hot and sweltering, but I dig it, and we're going to roll with this just as long as they deal it out, baby. Week before last, on our fake news parade of fools, we looked at Lawrence O'Donnell, limousine liberal, self-avowed socialist idiot. Well, socialist idiot. Or socialist, comma, idiot, because he wears both those hats really well. And he was grand marshal of the fake news parade 2 weeks ago. Then it was handed off last weekend to Chris Hayes, who said that if the Electoral College weren't provided for in the Constitution, it would be unconstitutional. To, you know, which a lot of people who know what's going on did a face plant and said, mother of pearl. And this week, the spotlight is on, who is that guy? MSNBC. Oh, Rachel Maddow. At the end of July, MSNBC's biggest and dullest conspiracy theorist got some pretty bad news. After almost a year of booming ratings, the Rachel Maddow show's viewership had crashed. It had been a long road for Maddow, the former blonde Catholic high school girl who decided she wanted to be a media personality and ended up with an MSNBC show through the efforts of Keith Olbermann. And after Keith was gone, well, MSNBC had to settle for a slightly less effeminate version of Olbermann in Maddow. Maddow retained the key elements of Olbermann's personality, the unhinged conspiracy theories, histrionic delivery, the dark hair, even the fashionably ugly, boxy black glasses. The former blonde not only looked and sounded like Olbermann, but she learned how to hit the same buttons in her audience. One man had made her MSNBC career possible, and another moved her show into the top cable slot. That man was Robert Mueller. There was no Russia conspiracy theory too bizarre or insane to earn a rant from Rachel. Going where few dared to go, Maddow began insisting that Russia was conducting a continuing operation and might even be in control of the White House and the entire country by now. And then the Mueller report and later Mueller's testimony destroyed all of Maddow's conspiracies. At the height of her Russian conspiracy theories, in which she connected everyone and their uncle to Moscow, Maddow could boast 4 million viewers while claiming to be the top cable news show. In July, she'd fallen to fifth place without even 2.5 million viewers to scrape together for her rants. If the viewers kept abandoning her, Apple, Bank of America, Mercedes, and other advertisers would too. Not dead air. I was going to drink. Desperate and nasty had always been Maddow's stock and trade. Olbermann's hateful screeds had been insecurity diluted into egomania and backwashed his furious tantrums. Maddow's insecurity bypassed egomania. She didn't have the chops to be on the air, and she knew it. The only way she could stay on MSNBC was by spewing crazy lies and trying to destroy everyone to the right of Bernie Sanders. In the middle of August, Maddow, her producers, and the voices in their heads decided to smear the grandson of Iraqi Jewish refugee grandparents as a white nationalist. In an NBC broadcast, she accused Stephen Menashe, a Trump judicial nominee, of writing a blood-curdling article offering a highbrow argument for racial purity by misreading, distorting, and misrepresenting his writing. Maddow repeatedly lied about the article and failed to even mention that it was about Israel. She falsely claimed that Menashe had written how definitely democracy can't work unless the country is defined by a unifying race. And this was the exact opposite of the point that the former Supreme Court Justice Alito clerk had made. Menashe's father was a Jewish immigrant from Iran. His father's parents fled Iraq because of the anti-Semitic Farhud program. His mother's family had fled Ukraine and Lithuania. All this made Maddow's accusation that he was a racial nationalist especially implausible, but it did not matter. Rachel Maddow hadn't even bothered to find out anything at all about Stephen Menashe before trying to destroy him. All that mattered were two things. First, Menashe was a Trump nominee, making him fair game for any lie, smear, and slander. And second, Maddow was sinking in the ratings and needed help. Going after Menashe might not turn things around, but the smear campaign might stop the bleeding. Rachel Maddow was trying to destroy a good man to keep Bank of America advertising on her show. Despite the backlash from legal thinkers, Maddow took her tirade to Twitter, offering screenshots with snippets of lines from a 122-page law review article about the challenges of diversity, while ignoring the conclusion that sometimes then differences must be openly acknowledged in the political sphere so that equality can be established on the basis of our differences rather than in the denial of them. Rachel Maddow is not incapable of reading a law article. Before her career as MSNBC's conspiracy theorist, she was a Rhodes Scholar. Rhodes Scholars are not necessarily geniuses. No one would mistake Bill Clinton, Cory Booker, or Peter Buttigieg for great minds, but Rachel Maddow could have read Mnuchin's article. Instead, she didn't care. Neither did her corporate employers at MSNBC or Comcast. Maddow has a quota of conspiracy theories to get through in every show, and Stephen Menashe was just one of the people she had decided to smear on one episode of her disinformation program. Some Jewish groups have accused Maddow of anti-Semitism, and while Maddow occasionally likes people to think she's Jewish, aside from one grandfather, the rest is Dutch, English, and Irish. And although she certainly opposes Israel, it's doubtful she even knew Menashe was Jewish. Maddow's drive-by smearing of Stephen Menashe was part of a pattern. In 2016, Maddow had accused Jeff Sessions of being a racist. The next year, she accused him of being in bed with the Russians. That trajectory neatly captured not only leftist smear campaigns, which have gone back and forth between accusing the president and his associates of either being Russians or racists, but also Maddow's erratic shifts from one smear tactic to another whenever it was convenient. Not dead air, just thinking about this. It's not just that Maddow is a radical or a hack, as she is. Nobody else would be allowed on MSNBC unless they were. But she's also pathetically bad at what she does. And her awfulness feeds her insecurities, which makes her behave even worse. Take the time she aired a misleadingly edited clip of Senator John McCain. She casually mentioned that there was an unfair edit and then breezed on into another rant. But airing misleadingly edited clips of Republicans is just something she does from time to time. things like actually knowing that the man you're smearing as a racist is the grandson of Jewish refugees, that the woman you're dismissing as a Department of Justice spokesperson was a law clerk, and the clip you're airing was edited to smear John McCain, those things don't matter to Maddow. They're not the point. It's what they can get you to believe. It's what they can sell. And that's why Maddow jumped the furthest and the deepest into the Russian conspiracy mud hole. Rachel Maddow has never seen words as anything other than a puzzle that could be combined in interesting shapes to hurt some people, mislead others, and keep her from having to work at Starbucks. The factual content of those words meant as little to her as calorie content labels mean to a monkey, or me, for that matter. Russia had given Maddow a world of conspiracy theories to spin into a paranoid universe of lies, and Apple, Bank of America, and Mercedes had been happy to pay for ads in between her crazed rants. Maddow never cared. Rachel Maddow has never cared about her credibility. She shot to the top of the pile through shameless stunts like claiming we've got Trump's tax returns. And after ranting and rambling for 20 minutes, she unveiled what they call in New York City bupkis. But it didn't matter, see, because the rubes and the dupes tuned in. Now, there are always going to be people with no shame willing to do anything to be on television. That's what makes Survivor, The Bachelor, Jerry Springer, and CNN panels possible. But the problem is the media likes to pretend it's better than that. But MSNBC didn't put Maddow on the air night after night, no matter what she did, how many lies she told, how many people she tried to destroy, and which conspiracy she peddled between breaks. That's not all they did. They brought her in to moderate the 2020 Democrat debates. And she isn't fundamentally different from other media. The Obermanette is just further down that slippery slope. The media puts narratives ahead of facts. Maddow is all narrative. All narratives without facts are conspiracy theories. The media believes that its goal is to destroy Republicans while at the same time maintaining its credibility. Maddow only cares about the first part, and she isn't worried about credibility. After Mueller, Maddow's viewership has taken a hit, not because they don't believe, but because they know there's not going to be any more exciting Mueller and Russia conspiracies on the show. Rachel Maddow succeeded because she understood that what her audience wanted was not factual reporting, but the drama of journalism without the substance. Maddow, like the media, implicitly promises to get Trump, but is happy to take out anyone more vulnerable along the way. This is the business that the rest of the media is in. Maddow's just more open about it. Once again, a shameless lying hacks conspiracy theories drive the media narrative. Rachel Maddow is nothing more than the face of today's establishment media. Well, I see we're down at the bottom of the hour, so here's what we're going to do real quick. We are going to be going to a brief musical interlude here and trivia question. You don't see these too many, but you're going to see one tonight. Next song coming up. Here's what I want. I want the name of the song. I want the artist. I want what it pertains to. You are listening to AACP, A Conservative Perspective, right here on the Patriot Nation Radio Network. Back after this.
golden sail and watches the ships that go sailing somewhere beyond the sea. She's there watching for me. If I could fly like birds on high, then straight to her arms.
James Bostic here at Conservative Perspective. Trivia time. Had a couple of... nobody was really even close. And I'm kind of surprised at that. However, it goes that way sometimes. That was the theme song in 1967 to a show that was a spinoff of the Batman theme. The Batman show. Now, that was the Brian Setzer Orchestra right there doing their cover of the theme from Batman. And they absolutely slay it. Because anything Brian Setzer does frickin' rules. But it wasn't. The artist, Al Hurt. When you think of great trumpet players, you know, people say Maynard Ferguson, and they would be correct. I was a big fan of Maynard Ferguson. Still somewhere around here have a Maynard Ferguson jet tone mouthpiece, which allowed me to scream that G above C. Herb Alpert. Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass. Chuck Mangione, although Chuck played a flugelhorn and not a trumpet, we're in that brass family. That was Al Hurt with the theme from The Green Hornet. Yeah, that's right. Van Williams and, of course, a very young Bruce Lee playing his aide, Cato. One of the reasons Bruce said that he got the part beyond his beyond his superhero physical skills, he was able to say the name of the character, the lead character, the guy Van Williams played, Britt Reed, without juxtaposing his L's and R's, so it didn't come out Blit Reed. Blit Lead. So, and of course, you know, he was a martial arts legend, but that was theme from The Green Hornet, Al Hurt. Now, welcome back to ACP. And of course, to smooth everything out, obviously, Bobby Darin, Beyond the Sea. A lot of great hits and a now, you want to talk about a talented guy whose life was tragically cut short. Right. I mean, Elvis, you know, at 42 and so many other great talents, you know, taken away at a young age. And Bobby Darin was no exception. I think he was 37. He had he killed it in Vegas. And the night that he died, he did a show in Vegas and they sent him to the hospital. He had to have heart surgery because there was some he had a very weak heart. And the doctors always told him, hey, man, you're going to have to slow it down. And he was, no, baby, I can't. This is not what I'm here for. I'm here to do Vegas. I'm here to do the strip. I'm here to do movies and TV specials. And he did all those things. And then at 37, bang. I remember as a kid, a couple years before he died, the Bobby Darin show. It was like a summer replacement for Flip Wilson or something. And he was an incredibly talented guy. Everybody knows him for Mac the Knife. Terrific tune. Same thing with Splish Splash, Dream Lover. But I think as I've gotten older, this is the tune that I really like to identify with Bobby Darin. Somewhere Beyond the Sea. Okay, we're back. We do this live Tuesdays and Thursdays, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Here at Patriot Nation Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com. We also have a recorded version of the show that goes out Sundays at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Mojo 50 Radio. Mojo50.com. It's your one-stop shop for the very best libertarian and conservative talk radio on the internet. That's all there is to it. Well, you know, it's so easy. Again, like I said, this is just another episode in an ongoing expose of why the left is kooky. We have another, I think it's like the fourth one if you're keeping track of them as they go by, another Democrat presidential debate coming up shortly. I'm not sure. I don't even know who's carrying it. I think ABC's carrying it. An 18-year-old freshman. And the graduate student teaching assistant in her women's studies class are talking about politics as they enter the campus coffee shop, and they have this exchange. The freshman says, well, what exactly is socialism? And the grad student goes, you have had a sheltered life, haven't you? Socialism is what people need. It keeps things working by telling people what to do. And the freshman says, but you said you did whatever you pleased. The grad student chuckled and says, touche. Well, some people know what's best for them and some people don't. Besides, socialists don't tell people what to do in a mean, petty way. They tell them what to do in a kindly way to keep them out of danger. Latte or cappuccino? One of the tactics that socialists use when they discuss their creed with normal people, like conservatives, is to define socialism very narrowly. They stipulate that socialism requires state ownership of the means of production. Now, such an explanation, which comes to us straight out of Marxist theory, would mean that Soviet communists were socialists while Nazi fascists weren't. But just as the word socialist is part of USSR, as in United Soviet Socialist Republics, it's also part of Nazi. By the way, also both regimes were totalitarian police states, but let's not get too sentimental. Regardless of whoever it is that owns the means of production, what all forms of socialism share is central control by the central government. And central control of the means of production means that the central government must also be in charge of the distribution of its products, its goods, and services. It's this aspect of socialism that those running for the presidential nomination for the Democrats are pushing. This year's Democrat candidates are all about $1,000 checks each month from the feds, the universal basic income, universal pre-K, free college, Medicare for all, including foreigners, yes, illegal aliens, you name it. Whatever folks need, the government will provide. But most of the central government spending is already distribution. the welfare state. Democrats will tell you that you've paid for your benefits, but most Americans get far more in benefits than what they paid in taxes. The difference between the two major parties is that while Republicans want to get some control over the growth of social programs that we already have, the Democrats are out and out statists who want to expand the welfare state, take over the means of production, and control everything. The most collectivist, most Sovietic candidate in the Democrat field is Bernie Sanders. Bernie will not be outdone by any of the other Democrat candidates, whatever they propose. He'll go further. Now he wants to cancel all medical debt. And like Clement Attlee in Britain after the Second World War, he'll attempt to nationalize key industries. Under Bernie, the feds will own the means of production, although his apologists might call it social ownership or some such nonsense. The one thing about Sanders that is better than the other top-tier candidates in the Democrat field is that he doesn't seem quite as much of a liar as the others. But for Americans concerned about Russia, Sanders should be the most unattractive candidate in the Democrat field. He even took his honeymoon in Mother Russia. And for those who are concerned about President Trump's alleged collusion with Russia, voting for Bernie would seem most inconsistent. So if a commie candidate like Sanders isn't your preferred type of socialist, then maybe Liz Warren might be more your cup of tea. Ms. Warren is a proponent of dirigism, a soft form of fascism. Warren claims to be a capitalist, but then she also claimed to be an American Indian. Forget about the blue eyes. A gal's got to do what a gal's got to do. How else are you going to break that glass ceiling? And Liz has a plan for everything. Why, even now, she's designing your life for you, and you should be grateful. And then there's Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who's on board with all the Democrats' radical plans for transforming America. What's different about Mayor Pete is that he has a Marxist pedigree. You see, Peter's dad was an admirer and a biographer of Antonio Gramsci. Antonio Gramsci was a Marxist who theorized that the way to undo capitalism was not by violent revolution, but from within. Gramsci, one of the architects of the West's current problems, was a much more prescient predictor than old Marx. So, Mayor Pete's a red diaper baby. Democrats want you to ignore that too. In April, the Washington Examiner ran, Pete Buttigieg's father was a Marxist professor who lauded the Communist Manifesto. It's an informative article, especially if one isn't up on their Gramsci. What's astounding is how a socialist like Buttigieg's old man could find employment at Notre Dame, even ascending to the chair of the English department. It appears Catholic colleges have the same rot as the public universities. On a side note, Democrats would be foolish to nominate Mayor Pete because much of the Democrats' base is socially conservative minorities and they won't be in the mood to vote for a queer. With queer studies in colleges and the LGBTQ, BBQ, ADHD, TV, that term can't be pejorative anymore, can it? I mean, I'm a damn self would vote for a queer if he were a true conservative. What repels me about Peter is his know-it-all attitude and his presumption. It reminds me of somebody we had in there a few years back. He can't even run a small city properly, yet he presumes to be able to run a superpower. That, Mr. and Mrs. America, is astonishing. I'm trying to think of a time when America has ever had to endure such a field of sanctimonious, morally superior clowns as the current crop of candidates for the Democrat nomination. And here's the thing, every single one of them, all of them, are socialists who want to take America even further into that fetid cesspool of misery. All of them want bigger and bigger government, even though time and time again, big government has shown itself to be the problem. There are no moderates in the Democrat field. Where are we supposed to think that government is more moral, more competent, and more admirable than the private sector? After all, it was the government that put us $22 trillion in debt. It was government that sent our kids off to die in stupid foreign wars that were the result of stupid foreign policy. It was government that did not protect American citizens from being killed, raped, and brutalized by American aliens rather than nationalizing the private sector. Maybe we should privatize the whole damn federal government. With control of both the means of production and the means of distribution, socialists would pretty much control something else, our lives. But then, some people just don't know what's best for them. No moderates. Go back and think about the time when all 20 candidates were on the stage. Everybody raised their hand because they would be willing to provide free health care to illegal aliens. Not free health care to the elderly. Not free health care to our veterans, to wounded warriors. Not free health care to the American citizen who cannot afford to pay, but free health care to illegal aliens. You got to be japing me, man. You'd have to straight up. It's gotten so bad on the left. They just become completely unhinged. Trump derangement syndrome rules throughout the Democrat left. I don't know if you've ever heard of Rebecca Mackay. I never had either. Apparently, in the literary world, she's a big deal. People know her. She's a serious author, they say. This is what she tweeted the other day. Is anyone else, this just goes to show you how crazy these SOBs are, is anyone else made really uncomfortable these days by anyone wearing any kind of red baseball cap? Like I see one and my heart does weird shit, and then I finally realize it only says Titleist or whatever. Maybe don't wear red caps anymore, normal people. Don't you just love the appropriation of the title normal by someone who can't cope with a primary color? But it doesn't end there. She goes on. And also, for the love of God, the clever folks wearing Make America Read Again or whatever hats, no. You're making everyone scared. Don't do it. You're scaring me. And then, of course, she goes full front-on swastika with Donald Trump. If you're here to be contrary, an equivalent would be Western Hindus choosing not to use the swastika symbol in public, despite it being sacred to their faith, because it would offend or frighten people. The red hat has become a symbol of hate because of how its wearers act. This is a textbook example of solipsism, and that is a philosophical concept that one's own mind is the only thing a person can know exists, from which many corollaries follow, but it is most quickly grasped thusly. Rebecca Mackay is the center of her own universe. And the center of her own universe starts with me. And then in the orbits are my stuff and stuff about me. And then stuff that I hate. And on the outer limit of all this is everyone else. That solipsism, and that's exactly what's going on here. So as you might expect, raucous guffaws of laughter from the right have greeted this petulant demand. Tweets like, maybe therapy is the answer for you. You're too fragile to handle a hat. We will continue to wear what we please because we are normal. We are not the ones with a mental illness which focuses on apparel choices. I was attacked by a Doberman as a child. This made me scared of all dogs. As an adult, I've only owned Dobermans. This is what killed what had become an irrational fear. I suggest you get a red hat and maybe a friend who wears one and regain some clearly much needed perspective and peace. People. This chick believes what she's saying is reasonable and normal. Just don't wear red hats, anybody, ever again. So you won't scare me. And I guarantee you there were people who read that tweet, as I say so often, thoughtfully rubbed their chin with thumb and forefinger and went, you know what? Back out, she's right. Honey, go get all the red hats. How many red hats do we have nowadays? That many, huh? Get them, would you? And bag them up and throw them away. They're scaring people, and that's just not who we are. We're just not red hat wearing scary people. So, 86 the hats, honey. Thanks. And I promise you there were some who did, okay? All right? So who's the fruit nut? Huh? Who's the moon bat? Who's the Zagnut bar here? Little Becky Cuckoo Bird? For posting her silliness? Or for the people that say, yeah, she's right. I've got to reexamine my entire existence. Jesus wept. Okay, well, that's about all the time we got. I'm going to go ahead and fold up the tent now because I'm a little bit tired. It's been a long day. And I want to thank you guys for being here with us this evening. ACP is heard here, of course, Tuesdays and Thursdays live, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We also have a recorded incarnation of the program that goes out Sundays, 4 p.m. on Mojo 50 Radio, mojo50.com. You can go there. You can check it out. It is ultimately your one-stop shop for the very best in libertarian and conservative talk radio on the internet. Thank you so much for the opportunity to hang out here and talk about stuff. We'll be back on Thursday promptly, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, taking a look at things as we do through a conservative's perspective. God bless you. God bless America. We'll see you on Thursday. Take care.